This is Jim Inkster, and we're pleased to begin our conversation with Robert Francis Kennedy Jr., the son of the fabled U.S. Senator who died in 1968 in the great city of Los Angeles. And Robert Kennedy is joining us from Los Angeles, but soon he'll be in Louisiana Thursday night. There is an opportunity for people to meet this fine gentleman. He is going to be a part of a beautiful Atchafalaya Basin ceremony, and Waterkeeper Alliance has teamed with Waterkeeper Warriors and 20 individual waterkeepers that are making a difference in the watershed they protect and preserve. And Dean Wilson has been chosen as one of the top in his field in the world for his work in the Atchafalaya Basin Keeper. And good morning to you, Robert Kennedy Jr.
Morning to you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's an honor to talk with you, and you have been involved in this endeavor for a while. I know you've been involved in many other environmental engagements. What was the catalyst for this one?
Well, I've been involved with I got involved initially with the Hudson River Keeper in 1984, and that was the first keeper, and it was started in 1966 by a blue-collar coalition of commercial and recreational fishermen who mobilized to reclaim the Hudson River from its polluters. We have in the Hudson the oldest commercial fishery in North America. It's 350 years old. It's a traditional gear fishery. They use the same fishing methods our fishermen do that were taught by the Algonquin Indians to the original Dutch settlers of New Amsterdam and then passed down through the generations. And one of the enclaves of the commercial fishery is a village called Croakville, New York, that's 30 miles north of New York City on the east bank of the river. And the people who lived there in 1966 were not your kind of prototypical affluent environmentalists. They were factory workers, carpenters, lathers, electricians. Half of the people made their living fishing or crabbing the Hudson. And in 1966, Penn Central Railroad began vomiting oil from a 4.5-foot pipe in the Croton Harmon rail yard, and it blackened the beaches. It made the shad taste of diesel, and all these men and women got together, 300 of them, in an American Legion Hall to talk about how to take their river back, how to reclaim the river from its polluters. And they actually had been to the government agencies that are supposed to protect Americans from pollution, and they were given the bum's rush. They were told, this is Penn Central Railroad, these are important people, we can't do anything about it. And they started that night. Almost all of them were former Marines. They were combat veterans from Korea, World War II. Croatonville had one of the highest mortality rates during World War II of any community in America. And it was a very patriotic community. But that night they started talking about violence. They saw something they thought they owned, which was the abundance of these fisheries and the purity of the water. And it was being robbed from them by large corporate entities over whom they had no control, and they had come to the conclusion that government was in cahoots with the polluters. So somebody suggested that they put a match to the oil slick and burn up the pipe. Somebody said they should roll a mattress up and jam it up the pipe. Mm-hmm. They were talking about floating dynamite into the Indian Point power plant, which was killing a million fish a day on its intake screens and taking food off their family tables. And then a guy stood up whose name was Robert Boyle. He was the outdoor editor of Sports Illustrated magazine. And he was also a Marine, former combat veteran from Korea. And he had discovered an ancient navigational statute called the 1888 Rivers and Harbors Act that said that it was illegal to pollute any waterway in the United States. You had to pay a big penalty if you got caught, but also there was a bounty provision that had never been enforced, and it said that anybody who turned in the polluter got to keep half the fine. And that night he said to him, let's not talk about breaking the law, let's talk about enforcing it ourselves. And they went out and they started suing polluters. They made hundreds of thousands of dollars. They built a boat. they began patrolling the river. They used bounty money to hire me in 1984 as their attorney. And after that, we brought over 500 successful lawsuits against Hudson River polluters. We forced polluters on the river to spend over $5 billion remediating the river. And today, Hudson is an international motto for ecosystem protection. It's the richest waterway in the North Atlantic. It produces more pounds of fish per acre, more biomass per gallon than any other waterway in the Atlantic Ocean or the equator. And the miraculous resurrection of the Hudson inspired the creation of keepers all across North America and the world. We now are the biggest water protection group in the world. We have 350 water keepers. Each one has a patrol boat. Each one has a specific waterway or a stretch of a river that they've given their life to protecting. And Dean Wilson is one of our proudest and most accomplished members, and he has been fighting for the HLI for decades. And we own the keeper name. We license the groups to get started, and they kind of operate as franchises. We're now in 44 countries. I'm going to Iraq and Jordan and Israel next week to launch water keepers in those countries, new water keepers. But, you know, Dean is an inspiration to everybody.
That he is. And Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is also an inspiration. He's a president and co-founder of Waterkeeper Alliance. He will be in Baton Rouge Thursday night, keynote speaker for the Basin Keepers 15th Annual Gala, and this will be at the Hilton Capital Center downtown. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., for those unfamiliar, along with his partner, created a bottled water company, Keeper Springs, which donated all of its profits to Waterkeeper Alliance. I believe this was over 20 years ago. A few years ago, he sold his stake to Nestle in exchange for a donation to local water keepers. And Robert Kennedy Jr., you're no Johnny come lately to this issue. How significant is it as far as the preservation of our waterways?
Well, you know, waterways all over the world are embattled right now. This is, you know, we have water refugees now all over the planet. And, you know, one of the big issues on the Atchafalaya has been the illegal logging. Dean has been leading the battle against that. And, you know, a great personal sacrifice and occasionally at risk, too. But all of the waterways, you know, you never win any of these battles to protect a waterway permanently. They're all temporary victories. When we cleaned up the Hudson, the pressure on the Hudson from developers and other people to kind of take it away from us increased. So, but, you know, these were the waterways. The Constitution of the state of Louisiana says that the Atchafalaya Basin belongs to the people of the state. It doesn't belong to the logging companies. It doesn't belong to big agriculture. It doesn't belong to the oil industry. It belongs to the people. Everybody has a right to use it and its fisheries. Nobody can use it in a way that will diminish or injure its use and enjoyment by others. This is the law in every state. It's ancient law. It goes back to Roman times. It was in the Code of Justinian. It's called the Public Trust Doctrine. And it's in the Magna Carta. And what it says is that with those assets that cannot be reduced by their nature, cannot be reduced to private property, in other words, the shared resource of the community, the air, the water, the wildlife, the fisheries, the wandering animals, those things belong to everybody, whether you're rich or poor, humble or noble, powerful or powerless, you have an absolute right to go on to the Atchafalaya, to enjoy those waters, to pull out a fish and bring it home and feed it to your family with the security that you're not poisoning somebody. And those rights, you know, large corporate entities are constantly trying to privatize these public trust resources and steal them from the public. And what we do as a waterkeeper movement is we're really a community coast guard. We go out in the waterway and we say, this belongs to everybody. Everybody has a right to use it. Nobody can use it in a way that will diminish or injure its use and enjoyment to others. And we enforce those public rights. We understand that we're not protecting the environment for the sake of the fishes and the birds. We're protecting it for our own sake, because nature is the infrastructure of our communities. And if we want to meet our obligation as a generation, as a civilization, as a nation, which is to create communities for our children that provide them with the same opportunities for dignity and enrichment and prosperity and good health as the communities that our parents gave us, we've got to start by protecting our environmental infrastructure, the air we breathe, the water, the wildlife, the landscapes and rivers that connect us to our past, to our history, that provide context to our communities, and that are the source, ultimately, of our values and our virtues and our character as a people.
Now, Robert Francis Kennedy Jr. has made an impact in his chosen passion of the environment, but he, of course, is also a professor of environmental law at Pace University. He's a man with a great education. He went to Harvard, the London School of Economics, the University of Virginia Law School. And there are many, and you have heard them through the years, who have tried to coax you into getting into the political fray as a candidate. Why have you opted not to go this route?
You know, I enjoy my life. I enjoy advocating for waters. I have 7 kids and a very, very happy life. And I like this kind of, you know, local grassroots fight. And I think I like it a lot better than the kind of life I would be living if I was a politician and raising money from a lot of people that maybe I didn't like. I get to hang out with people who I really love all the time, and, you know, to be in a battle that's meaningful for things that are enduring and for things that, you know, that are, I think, essential to my whole value system.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr., perhaps the most noted environmentalist in the United States, on Thursday night, October 10th, keynoter at the Basin Keepers 15th Annual Anniversary Gala. He will be on hand to set up an honor for Dean Wilson appropriately, who is being recognized as one of the top water keepers in the world. And this is a passion among a few for Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who, of course, is a man who was famous before he was an adult, and he is the son of the former U.S. Senator Robert Kennedy and Attorney General, and the nephew of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, the 35th American president. Did they have this kind of passion for the environment, your uncle and your dad?
I would say, yeah. I mean, our family was really oriented toward the water. And, in fact, I'll tell you a story. When I was 8 years old, I wrote a letter to my uncle, who was then in the White House, telling him I wanted to see him about pollution. And he had me into the Oval Office. And I told him that I was going to write a book about pollution at that time. And he arranged for me to meet Rachel Carson and Stuart Udall, who was his Secretary of the Interior, from, you know, a great environmentalist from Arizona. And Stuart Udall would have been in Mexico. Stuart Udall became very, very close to my father. And if my father had won if he had survived 1968 presidential election, he intended to name Stuart Udall as his Secretary of the Interior. And Udall had arranged for my family to go on many of the Western Whitewater rivers, and this was a time when, you know, people weren't doing a lot of whitewater. But my father taught us to kayak and hard shell kayaks when we were little kids, and we went on the snake and the salmon and the yampa and the green and the Colorado, the Little Colorado, the Upper Hudson, all the great whitewater stretches. We went mountain climbing. He loved the outdoors. And, you know, we were schooled with the idea that this was part of our heritage, that the Purple Mountains majesty was part of the thing that made America what it is, and that we needed to make sure that those assets were preserved for future generations.
You were 9 when the president died and 14 when your father was killed. How often do you think of them, Robert?
I think of them all the time because just the nature of my work, you know, is making kind of constant references to the things that they stood for and to those kind of enduring values, I think. You know, I think they genuinely were, they wanted America to live up to its highest ideals. They saw this country as an exemplary nation, not because of the size of its weapons or the power of its armies, but because of what it represented to a hope for mankind, an experiment in self-governance, an experiment in human dignity. And they really wanted us to, our country, to live up to those values of being an example to the rest of the world, not forcing democracy on people at the, or our brand of democracy on people at the barrel of a gun. Like modeling those virtues in the hope that others would want to imitate them because of their success in our country. And I think, oh, their deaths really put it, were two of the traumas that pushed us down a road toward plutocracy, toward becoming a national security state. And I think, you know, it's important to understand their lives in that context.
And they were taken so young. The president, John, was 46. Your dad was 42. You're now 65 years old, and I'm sure not a day goes by when you don't think that you've outlived your father by 23 years and probably will last a lot longer. And the curious thing, Robert Kennedy Jr., he could still be alive.
Sure, he could. It's been now 50 years since he died. My mom is 91. I think my dad would probably be 95 if he had survived.
And you have a long lifespan in that family, as we know, but a family touched often by tragedy, and including your own siblings. It has to be something that is difficult to deal with, the fact that you've been blessed with so many great things, but yet at the same time have had to face tragedy so many times in so many different ways.
Well, you know what? That's just true for everybody. We have a big family, so we probably see more of it than other people. But, my mom said to me when I was a little kid, everybody takes their licks. And, you know, our family had the kind of tragedies that everybody experienced, but we also had tremendous good fortune. And, you know, I think that's what all of us try to focus on.
Now, you were born into privilege, but you have obviously done your best to give back. Do you think that's lost on a lot of people today in our world in which we basically try to get as much as we can, even if we are born ahead of the pack, we want more and more and more?
Are you asking me whether I think that greed and selfishness are more prevalent today than they were 2 decades ago?
Yes.
I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, I see a lot of idealism, particularly in young people. But I don't know. Sometimes it seems that way. Sometimes it seems like we've lost touch with important values that you know, our democracy is being taken over by large corporations and corporate values. And, you know, that may be a demoralizing factor in people's lives where they're less willing to contribute. So I really don't know. Sometimes it seems that way. I mean, if that's what your question is, I don't know the answer to it. It's something to ponder.
Well, I'll leave you with this. You are certainly aware, as we all are, of climate change and the risks and what people born after us will face. And yet people of our vintage are, in many cases, unwilling to accept this. And there is a lot of anti-intellectualism going on. How dangerous is that to our society?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of questions there. On the issue of climate change, I believe the best remedy for climate change is free market capitalism. Right now, you know, I'm in the business of building solar plants, wind plants, renewable transmission, and it now costs about $1 billion a gigawatt to build a solar plant, about the same, now actually growing less for wind. It costs $5 billion to build a coal plant, $5 to $7 billion to build a gas turbine, and about $9 to $20 billion to build a gigawatt of nuclear power. So we could make energy burning prime rib if we wanted to, but, you know, we ought to use the cheapest form of energy. The only way that carbon can prevail in our marketplace is through huge subsidies and through political favoritism. And, you know, the carbon titans have done an excellent job at capturing the agencies that regulate energy and corrupting public officials so that they can maintain this giant flow of subsidies to their industry. But even with all the subsidies to coal and oil, we're still beating them. Last year, globally, 63% of the new generation that was created in wind and solar, in renewables. And that was not that's despite the huge government subsidies that go to coal and oil. So even though the playing field is slanted against us, we're still beating them. But the real, you know, challenge is recovering our democracy. If we have democracy and we have true free markets, the climate crisis is easily solvable. We have technology, and it's much cheaper now to build renewables. And electric cars are better than internal combustion engines in almost every way. Oh, we can switch quickly if we can get the rest of the political power away from the carbon incumbents.
Robert F. Kennedy, thanks for your service to our country, and thanks for joining us today. And once again, Thursday night at downtown at the Hilton Capital Center, the 15th anniversary gala of the Waterkeeper Alliance, Basin Keepers event. Robert F. Kennedy is our keynoter for that event, and we thank you for joining us once again.